I just wanted to take a second just to thank you for making me feel so welcome and for being such an amazing body this week. You guys really lifted me up and encouraged me. I feel like I made a lot of friends this week, so it's been awesome for me. So thank you very much for being so hospitable and loving to me. So in the tradition of the week, we will begin with some Red Skeleton, horrible, terrible, don't even think about following this recipe for the perfect marriage. My wife told me the car wasn't running well because there was water in the carburetor. I asked where the car was. She told me, in the lake. I haven't spoken to my wife in 18 months. I don't like to interrupt her. There were a couple I didn't read that I thought, you know, that's a little close to the line. Okay.
Freedom.
So, here we are.
Freedom.
You can approach me afterwards if you want. So, this week, we've reviewed what it looks like to give your life to God. A life given to God will enter into a personal relationship with Him, will learn to put God first, and will put on the new self, the Lord Jesus Christ. And tonight, we'll look at one final quality of such a life. It loses itself. How do we lose our life? From our earliest memories, most of us have been taught to save our life, to guard and protect our life. The message from childhood is, be safe, be careful. And then Jesus comes along and says something very different. And if you've done your homework and brought your hand out, this is the first verses that you'll see there in Matthew 16, 24 and 25. Jesus says to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Now, it's very important to underscore, in these verses, Jesus is not talking about salvation. After all, salvation is a free gift. We cannot do anything to earn or deserve it. All it requires is faith. He's talking about what is required to follow him fully. And he has three things he mentions. Number one, we deny ourselves, so we stop living for ourselves. Secondly, we take up our cross. That means we're willing to suffer for him. And third, we follow him, and that is wherever he leads. In verse 25, I feel like he presents a summary of those three requirements by saying, whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. This is optional. This is not a commandment. He's saying, if you want to give your life to me fully, this is what is required. And in a nutshell, we must lose our life. When I first heard this idea as a new believer, it felt a little threatening and kind of confusing. After all, how do I go about losing my life? I found that the book of Romans provides a lot of insight into this question. Romans is perhaps the greatest and most influential letter ever written in human history. It explains the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and in particular, it explains what happened on the cross, unlike any other New Testament book. So it shouldn't surprise us that Romans addresses this all-important question, how do we lose our life? Yesterday, you may recall, we did a flyover of Ephesians, and tonight, we're going to crank it up a little. We're going to do a flyover of the book of Romans. Ambitious. But let's give it a shot. There are 16 chapters in Romans. The first 11 are all about Christian doctrine. That's just dealing with what we should believe. Okay? In chapters 1 through 11, Paul writes extensively about the righteousness of God and about our unrighteousness and the great mercy that God has extended to us in spite of our unrighteousness. So those are chapters 1 through 11. Chapters 12 through 16 are all about behavior, dealing with how we should live, how we should behave in light of his mercy. So you've got the first 11 chapters, right? All about our doctrine, what we should believe. And then we've got the last five chapters are all about behavior, how to behave in light of that. And right in between those two sections of Paul's letter, in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, it's an all-important transition verse between the first 11 and the last five chapters. So let's drill down into this all-important transition verse. It is so illuminating. It's in your handout. Paul writes, "Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship." Okay, let's take that apart. He starts off, "Therefore," a very important word, because what he is saying there, when he says "therefore" at the beginning of that, is he's saying, in light of everything I've just explained to you in these first 11 chapters, let me have a conclusion for you. "Therefore, I urge you," this is not required, it's not a commandment, this is optional, this is voluntary. "Therefore, I urge you, brothers," he is speaking to those who are in Christ, those who have put their faith in Jesus. This includes brand new believers and those who are in Christ for years. In fact, it's very interesting that as Paul wrote this, there were believers who were in Rome who most likely were in Jerusalem at Pentecost. The nations were gathered. They spoke in many tongues. There most likely were people who were there in Jerusalem, and they heard that, and they went back to Rome. And here it is about 20 years later. So this is a wide range of people that Paul is writing to. "Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice." Chapters 1 through 11 of Romans give an enormous view of God's mercy. And in view of the mercy of God, Paul is calling us to respond by offering our bodies as a living sacrifice. In view of God's mercy, in view of what I've just written to you in these first 11 chapters, here's what I want you to do. Offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. So to give our lives fully to God, to lose our lives, we must have a clear view of God's mercy. We must behold God and His mercy, or else you're not going to give your life as a living sacrifice. Now in Romans chapters 1 through 11, Paul offers many compelling examples of God's mercy. And in your handout, you can see some homework that I did one day where I went through the first 11 chapters and I was just looking for the mercies of God, the goodness, the grace, the kindness of God. Highly recommend that you do this on your own. But there you've got my study notes. I'm not going to go through all those. I just want to give them to you so you can check those out if you're interested in your spare time. But I want to underscore just a few, just to give you a flavor for the mercies of God. So zip down to chapter 2, verse 4. He gives riches of kindness, tolerance, and patience that leads to repentance. Chapter 3, verse 24. He justified us as a free gift of His grace. That idea of being justified, what it means, and this is profound, Jesus takes on all of our unrighteousness and the punishment that we deserve, and in exchange, we receive His righteousness. Whoa. He takes on all of our unrighteousness, all the punishment, and in exchange, we get His righteousness. Try to wrap your mind around that. That is one of the greatest mercies of God. Chapter 3, verse 25, Jesus died publicly to appease God's wrath and judgment against us. Going down to chapter 5, verses 8 and 10, while we were sinners, Jesus died on the cross for us. He died for us while we were helpless, and even His enemies. Chapter 8, verse 1, He has removed all condemnation. It's gone. Chapter 8, verses 9 through 11, we now belong to Him and His Holy Spirit. The very Spirit of Jesus lives inside of us. Chapter 8, 14 and 16, He's adopted us into His family. He's made us His sons and daughters. Chapter 8, verse 18, He helps us endure the sufferings of this life. We're not alone in that. Chapter 8, 28, He causes all things to work together for our good. And the last one I'll highlight, chapter 9, verse 33, we will never be disappointed by Him. What an amazing promise. What a mercy as we follow Him, put our faith. He promises, you'll never be disappointed in me. And I'm going to come back to that at the very end of this talk. So in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. Some translations, instead of saying offer your bodies, some translations will use the word present there. The word used for offer, present, it's the same Greek word. It's I believe that you pronounce it peristemi in the original Greek. And it's in the aorist active verb tense. Now, Don't let me fool you. I am not a Greek scholar. I got this from someone who is, okay? And I thought this was incredibly insightful. The fact that it's in the aorist active verb tense, it means this is a one-time act. The Greek word is so much, the Greek language is so much more robust than our English language. This is a one-time act, and this is profoundly insightful. This word, peristemi, is the same word and the same verb tense that's used in Luke 2:22 when Mary and Joseph brought Jesus from Bethlehem to Jerusalem to dedicate him as their firstborn son, as was required in the law of Moses. And Luke 2:22 says, they, Joseph and Mary, brought him, Jesus, their new baby, up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. To present is in the aorist active verb tense. The point being, how many times did they bring Jesus to dedicate him, to present him?
One time,
exactly, one time. And so going back to Romans 12:1, offer your body as a living sacrifice. It's a one-time act. You give your life to God. You present yourself one time. Romans 12:1 says, this is your spiritual act of worship. That's at the end of that verse. And it's very interesting if you look at another translation, the King James, the New King James. Instead of saying this is your spiritual act of worship, it says this is your reasonable service. And I love that. This is reasonable. Really? To present myself as a living sacrifice? Yes. When you have a massive view of the mercy of God, this is reasonable. This is not a stretch. In fact, I'd even say this is pretty natural. As a living sacrifice, that means that you die to the self-life, but you are alive to God. But what does this mean in practical terms? What does it look like to present your body as a living sacrifice, as a one-time act? Years ago, as a new believer, I was working at Coca-Cola. I had the opportunity to get away from it for some extended time, kind of like what we're doing here at Mo Ranch this week. I was very moved as I went through that time by the presence of God, by the worship, by the fellowship, and certainly what I learned about God and about his mercies. I learned a lot about his mercy, his grace, his love, and there was an especially poignant time when we focused on Jesus' slow and painful death on the cross. And as I meditated on Jesus dying on the cross for me, and this is key, if you're just thinking God died for everybody, I mean, that's true, but you got to understand this is personal, everybody. This is for me. This is for you. And it's profound when you meditate on what he has done for you personally. And when I meditated on what he did for me, my eyes were opened to this greater mercy in a way that I had never understood before. Let me try to explain what happened. As I meditated on that, I had a picture in my mind. I saw Jesus hanging on the cross, and I looked at him, and the nails were through his hands and through his feet. Isaiah 52:14 says that his appearance was disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form was marred beyond human likeness. And this is what I saw. He was so badly scourged and abused that he was completely covered in lacerations and wounds, in blood and sweat. I never even in a movie had seen anything like it. His hair was matted down and it partially blocked his face. But as I looked upon his face, I was able to see through his hair, and I was able to look into his eyes. And what I saw was a love that I've never gotten in touch with before. I saw no anger, no condemnation for me. You know, Rob, your sin is what could, I saw none of that. What I saw was the most pure love and acceptance. I cannot begin to describe. And his eyes just peered into me, and it was just pure love and goodness for me. He looked at me, and I saw the mercy of God like I had never seen it before. And in that moment, Jesus' grace and his love became so much more personal and real. It's difficult to describe, but I was just overwhelmed by God and his goodness and mercy. Remember, in Romans 12:1, therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy. With this greater view of mercy, it was a reasonable response for me to give my life to him, to offer myself to him as a living sacrifice. And my response to him was, Lord, if this is what you've done for me, you can take my life. You can do anything you want with it. You can send me anywhere you want. It was a point of consecration. It was a point of surrender. It was a point of presenting myself as a living sacrifice. I let go of my plans for my life, and I said, I trust you. If this is what you have done for me, I trust you completely in view of that love and that mercy. You may recall, earlier this week, I told you that growing up I had a fear that if I got serious with God, he might send me to Africa. Well, with this greater view of God's mercy, that fear just melted away. It was okay. And I said, God, if you want to send me to Africa, I'm in. Whatever you want to do with me. In Isaiah chapter 6, there's an example of a man who responded to this greater view of the mercy of God. And this is in your handout. In chapter 1 of Isaiah 6, Isaiah writes, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted. What I hear there is Isaiah had a view of God's mercy that changed him. I saw the Lord seated on the throne, high and exalted, the glory, the goodness of God. And in verse 5, Isaiah records his response. And his response was, woe to me. I am ruined, for I'm a man of unclean lips. And I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. And then in verse 8, he says, then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, send me. Isaiah's response, here am I, send me, was a reasonable response to the mercy of God in light of what he saw. And the rest of Isaiah's life was launched out of that moment with God. Looking back on my story, I see that God used my response to his mercy to launch the rest of my life. It put me into a whole different trajectory for my life that I believe was right in line with the will of God for me. And this happened while I was working at Coca-Cola. I've been telling you guys about that throughout the week. So let me reconnect back into that story. At that time, at Coke, God had been teaching me to trust him, to follow him, to help people understand who Jesus is in corporate America, to be a light in the darkness, to share my faith. But there was still a part of me that was thinking, gee, should I stay here, should I leave? And at that time, I was working on the Diet Coke team, and I remember I started to see God working around me. And just to give you an example, there was a young guy who I hired onto the team, and he took a real interest in my spiritual life. He got into a Bible study that I was leading, and we started having these incredible conversations about faith. That was amazing to me. The more that I grew in my faith, the more that I saw my passion for the Coke business decline and my passion for God and his kingdom increase. I became involved in various Bible studies and ministry away from work, which often required that I be out the door at 5:30, which in my job, in that department, was truly career suicide. So as I would head to the elevator at around 5:30, not all the time, but with some regularity, people looked at me kind of weird, like, really? But I would just smile and trust God, because I had prayed about it, and I felt like God was saying, yeah, that's what I want you to do. Trust me with this. And as this unfolded, I noticed I started to become even more effective in my job. God gave me favor on projects. Things just came together. Things worked out. And I was promoted to run two of our regional brands. I still wondered about leaving the company. I remember one day I had lunch with a friend, and I told him about it. I was kind of wrestling with it. He said, Rob, God created the world. Don't you think if he wants you to have another job that he can handle that? And that just really spoke to me, and I thought, okay, I need just to let go of this. I decided to stop looking around, just put my head down, and work, and just do a good job, and what the Lord wanted me to do there in terms of making him known in the workplace. Well, several months later, I received a phone call out of the blue. And it was from our global marketing group, and they were looking for someone who to be the brand manager for the Coca-Cola brand for the world. And they wanted to interview me for that, and I about fell out of my chair. Well, the day came to interview. I met with all these vice presidents in the morning after lunch. I went to meet with the chief marketing officer in the corporate tower on the top floor. I was waiting outside his office. He was on a call. I had a moment. I stepped into a phone booth just to kind of collect myself. I never met the guy. He had quite a reputation. I stepped into the phone booth and I prayed and I said, "Lord, I don't know if you want me to have this job, but I just want your will to be done. But the one thing I ask is, would you please give me an opportunity to share my faith with this man? I know that's why I'm here." I was ushered into his palatial office. He was on the phone with Michael Ovitz, who at that time was the most powerful man in Hollywood. I sat down, and I could tell that Sergio, he's the chief marketing officer, he was just throwing his power around in this phone call, dropping F-bombs everywhere, ordering this guy around, the most powerful guy in Hollywood. And I sat there, and I just kind of took in the moment in the office. I looked on his desk, and I noticed that his coffee cup had the devil on it, literally. And that kind of put a chill down my spine, and I thought, oh boy, what am I in for? He got off the phone, he tore right into the interview, and I had interviewed all morning with his vice presidents, and every question he asked me was different from any question anyone had asked me. And I'm thinking, this guy's just trying to get into my brain in some way. And you've watched professional tennis where they just smash the ball back and forth on these great volleys. That's the way this interview went. Because he was coming at me hard, and I realized, if I'm going to get this job, I got to come right back at him, because that's the kind of person he wants to be running his biggest brand for the world. And so it was this vicious tennis match between us. And these crazy questions that kept coming at me, and I would just slam them back at him and hit another one, and I'd take it right back at him. To give you an example, out of nowhere, he said, "When do you want to retire?" I said, "I don't know when I want to retire." And he said, "What do you want to do when you retire?" And I said, "I really haven't thought about it. I would imagine I'd like to serve in some capacity." "How old are you?" I said, "I was 32 or 33. And he said, "Well, when I was about your age, I remember I was supposed to have lunch with a friend. He blew me off. I got angry. I called the secretary, you know, where the hell is he?" And she said, "He's at a retirement planning seminar." And Sergio got all angry, had a huge temper. He met with the guy, he reamed him out, and then the guy explained to Sergio why he was going to retirement planning. And so Sergio said, "So I realized actually it's a pretty wise thing to do, long-term planning." And so I went and I started putting together an estate plan and a will and all these things for the future. So Sergio was in the process of lecturing me on the benefits of long-term planning. And the Lord just prompted me out of nowhere. And I cut him off. I said, "Excuse me, Sergio, can I ask you one question?" And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Do you know where you're going when you die?" And he looked at me and he was stunned. And he kind of was shaken. And he stumbled. And he said, "No, I haven't figured that out." And I looked him in the eye, and I said, "Sergio, I know exactly where I'm going when I die." And he just kind of sat there and took it in, and then he just tore into the next question, and the tennis match continued, if you know what I mean. And in that moment, I realized, I either just destroyed my career, which has been going pretty well at this point, or this guy knows I've got what it takes to be in this job. And the next day, I got the job offer. The job started. It was clear that God put me in the job. That is a key point. He opened the door, right? I was following him. He opened the door. God gave me this job. I was so excited about this new job. It was kind of a dream for me to market Coca-Cola, the number one brand in the world, all over the world. And so I went into this, and I couldn't wait to dig my teeth into it. And as I started, I figured he's got plans for relationships. He was working back in, you know, the Coke USA, where I was now, and I'm in the global marketing group, a whole different building, different people. Surely God has great plans to connect me with people, to tell them about him. None of that happened. Every interaction with people, as I traveled around the world and back in Atlanta, it was just business, business, business. There was no time for a relationship, nothing. And I started to pray, and I said, "Lord, I don't get this. You've taught me why I'm here. It's to represent you and make you known. You're the one that opens doors. Every door is closed. What is going on?" And I was reading the Bible. I was in the New Testament reading Exodus, reading about Moses leading his people out of Egypt. And the Holy Spirit spoke to me one day, and I thought he said, "Rob, Coca-Cola is Egypt for you, and you're in bondage. And I'm going to take you out." And that was the most confusing thing to me. I said, "What? you put me in this, and you're taking me now. Maybe I didn't hear that right. So, you know, I kind of kept processing that, and that message was just continuous for me. And I said, Lord, okay, if you're telling me to leave, you've got to make this so abundantly clear I can't miss it, because you made it so clear you put me in it. And I don't want to miss you on this. I want to follow you. Time went on. We were having this huge meeting. We brought in the top 15 countries to have a meeting with them. And I was working very hard. The day for the meeting came, I went to the office, I put my stuff down, I had to go to another building. Coke has like 5 different buildings on the campus. And I got in the elevator, I'm going down, and the elevator got stuck. And I thought, oh my gosh. I got in with security, and they said, try this, try that. Nothing worked. Elevator was stuck. And they said, well, we'll have someone over right away to get you off. And I said, well, two things. Can you call this conference room and tell them that I'm not sure when I'll be there. Go ahead and start the meeting. And secondly, take your time. I've been really busy lately. I could use a little quiet time. And I meant it had been very busy. I sat down on the floor of the elevator, and I said, okay, God, you've got my total attention. I know you're in control of everything, including elevators. I don't know anyone's ever been stuck in an elevator. It makes a cute sitcom plot, but here I am. What are you trying to say to me? And I sat there and I closed my eyes and I just tuned in as best as I could to God. And all of a sudden, something very unusual happened. I had a vision. It's like a video went out of my mind, or like a trance. In the book of Acts, we see that Peter had a trance of the sheep that came down out of the sky and the animals were on it. God said, eat. Well, I had a trance like that. And all of a sudden, the video in my mind was that the elevator came loose. It started moving down very slowly, and God said to me, you are in a box, and this represents your time at Coca-Cola. You've been here for almost 7 years, and 7 represents my number of completion. And your life has been very contained in this little box, and I've got so much more for you. The elevator came to a rest on the bottom floor, the doors opened up, and I stepped out, not into the lobby, but into what I would describe as Psalm 23. It was the most inviting, beautiful, pastoral, you know, rolling hills, beautiful pools of water with sunshine bouncing off. It was so inviting, and the Lord said, this is what I have for you. And in that moment, security came on the intercom and said, Mr. Ketterer, we're going to have you out of here very soon.
Wow.
And I came out of that trance, and the voice actually came out of the, you know, out of the speaker in the elevator, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's true, God, and you've made it so abundantly clear, you really are taking me out. I went to the meeting, everything that happened in that meeting reinforced what had happened. After that, I was praying, it's like, Lord, you didn't say when. You said we're leaving, but you didn't say when. I started to pray for when. A few weeks later, I'm sitting in my office, and it's when. I'm in my office, I'm sitting there, I'm about to meet with my boss, and I did something I rarely did. I took my Bible out. You ever do the flip and just kind of look? And I did that, and my eyes went right down to John 14:31, which reads, Jesus said, come now, let us leave.
Wow.
And I thought, and the words were just burning in my heart. And I said, now? Yes. Now, like I'm about to go meet my boss, who I'm going to go resign right now. Yes. Okay. Got up, sat down with her. She looked at me. She said, what is it? And she was this brilliant woman from India, very intuitive. And I said, Vanita, I do have something I want to talk about, but why don't we do our agenda first? And she said, no, what is it? And I said, trust me on this. And she said, no, let's talk about that right now. And I said, well, Vanita, I'm resigning. And she said, I know you've been under a lot of stress and want to take some time off and this and that. And I said, I'm ready to go. But if you'd like for me to take time off, I'll do it. I took the rest of the week off. I came back. And in that time off, the Lord said, I want you to leave with a good testimony. So when I met with her on Monday, when I came back, I said, Vanita, I am resigning. And I know this is a shock. I will stay as long as you want me to stay, within reason, because I'm ready to go. But I don't want to put a burden on you. If you would like for me to hire someone and train them, I'll do that. And I just felt like that's what the Lord had said to me. She really appreciated that. Hired someone, did some training, and Vanita said, she set the date of when I would leave. And when I looked at the calendar, it was exactly 7 years and 7 days since I had started with the company. And remember in the elevator, the Lord said, 7 is my number of completion. Did the Lord put a bow around that or what?
That's awesome.
Remember, all of this flowed out of presenting myself as a living sacrifice to God. 26 years ago, I followed the Lord's leading and I left. I left Coca-Cola. The Lord didn't tell me what to do. I told you that a few times this week. And when I left, I had been writing, and I thought, well, maybe I'll do some writing. Maybe that'll turn into a vocation. I did that. This turned into a time of just kind of healing from corporate America. I was pretty banged up and bruised. I didn't even realize it. But months later, there was still no income. I had some finances saved. I was burning through that. And I tried to get published, you know, with the stuff I wrote. And none of that went anywhere. And I said, well, Lord, you open and close doors. The doors are closed. What do you want me to do? You told me to leave. You didn't tell me what to do. I know you want me to work. What should I do? It was a real wilderness time of crying out and saying, God, what do you want me to do? It was hard. But I never doubted because God made it so clear to me. And some little scrappy consulting projects started to surface. If my colleagues back at Coca-Cola knew what I was doing, frankly, I would have been embarrassed. They were beneath me. But the Lord said to me, he was faithful in a very little thing. To him will be given much. So I said, okay, God's teaching me humility. So let me do these little things, and I'll trust God with that. And this was the beginning of a new career for me. These little scrappy things turned into something a little more, and on it went. And God brought this whole new career out of the ground. I never looked for it. I didn't want to be a consultant. I considered that years ago, and I said no, because that means being on a plane all the time. And the Lord said, I got plenty of business in Atlanta. Who said you have to be on a plane? See, God thinks so differently and so creatively and breaks our paradigms. I never thought I had my own business. I'm not an entrepreneurial type. I'm very much an employee. But God had a plan, and he gave me a business that I could run, kind of like, you know, as an employee. I'm an independent consultant. I just am an extension of a lot of different small companies in Atlanta. And it's a business that God, where he would give me plenty of margin, there's that word again, margin, to reach out to non-believers and to disciple men. And today, and for many years, about half of my time is in my consulting work, and about half of my time is doing ministry. And I absolutely love it. I can't believe where God has brought me. I cannot overemphasize the value of margin in what God has done. That's why I made such a big deal of it this week. Looking back, thinking about my life, the Psalm 23 vision has unfolded. There have also been four very painful seasons in the time since I left, but I wouldn't trade those things. God used those to teach me, to build me up, to reveal himself more to me. Here's the key. I had to lose my life to find it. I hope you're really hearing that. I had to lose it to find it. So as I wrap up, let's go back to where we started in Matthew 16, 24. If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. I mentioned earlier that when I first heard these ideas, they felt a little threatening and confusing. I wasn't sure how I would go about losing my life. Paul's letter to Romans teaches us that to lose your life is to offer yourself to God as a living sacrifice. And the only way to do that is if we have a great view of his mercy, the amazing goodness, kindness, grace of God, ultimately demonstrated on the cross. The cross is the centerpiece. There is no greater demonstration of the love of God. To bring it full circle, we'll only discover this view of his mercy by staying focused on the one thing. Jesus, intimacy with him. As we do that, that's where he teaches us these things. Remember Tuesday morning, Luke 10:41, Martha and Mary, and Jesus rebuked to Martha, 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 you're worried and bothered about so many things, but only one thing is necessary. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken from her. As the one thing becomes our one thing, your one thing, we will gain a view of God's mercy that if you keep going with it, it ultimately will overwhelm you. And when that happens, it will be reasonable to present your body as a living sacrifice to God. Like Isaiah said, we will be ruined. Our self-life will hit a tipping point, and we will be ready to abandon ourselves to the Lord, to lose our life. And Jesus promises, whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. I've shared what has happened in my life since I presented myself to God as a living sacrifice and how God has worked in my life. But what about you? What will happen? Well, I wondered about this. It's like, Lord, what do I say to these people at this point? And he said, you might want to read the next verse. So Romans 12:2 has a brilliant answer for us. And that's in your handout. Romans 12:2, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. So what will happen to you? Well, God will work in you more than ever to remove the worldly ways from your life and to transform you by the renewing of your mind. And you will be on the path to God's will for your life. God has the ultimate and the very best plan for your life. You can't figure it out on your own. I couldn't get there on my own. The only way to find and live out that plan is by giving your life to God as a living sacrifice. So, I've been wrapping up all these talks with application. And tonight's application, I feel, is a little more special. Give your life to God by losing your life. Present yourself as a living sacrifice. Now, as I say that, you still may be wondering, how do I do that? Well, let me suggest a way. To me, it's a very practical way. And this is in your handout. I wanted you to have this. So if this is something God's stirring in you tonight, I want you to have this in case this is a little exercise that you might want to do, something between you and God. Picture yourself entering the throne room of God. Hebrews 4:16 says, let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence. This is something God invites us to do, to come into the throne room of God. So picture yourself. Just have a mental picture in prayer before God. Go into his throne room. And as you enter the throne room, envision God the Father seated on the throne. And Jesus, of course, is seated at his right hand, right where the scripture tells us he would be. So picture that. Go there before the Lord. And as you come before the throne, meditate on the mercy of God. And you might want to pause there for a while. You know, for me, I went to the cross, and that's where I recommend you go. But you might want to do your own study of Romans 12. And those verses from Ephesians chapters 1, 2, and 3 we looked at yesterday, those are other, loaded with the mercy of God. Meditate on these things. Go there and allow yourself to be overwhelmed. This is not something that you concoct emotionally. This is real. This is Jesus, what you have done for me. Like Isaiah said, I'm ruined. I'm ruined as I behold this great God. Imagine that there's an altar before the throne. Step outside of yourself. Lift yourself up and place yourself on the altar. Present yourself as a living sacrifice. Just step outside of yourself, as you can imagine. Pick yourself up. Put yourself on this altar before the throne and present yourself. God, I'm done. I'm done. I'm here to lose my life. I trust you. There's no one who could love me more than you. There's no one I could trust more than you. This to me is a very actionable way of presenting yourself as a living sacrifice. And I think it's fairly simple, too. Come to the Lord and present yourself as a living sacrifice. Give your life to God. And remember that little verse we saw in Romans 9? God promises you will not be disappointed. You will not be disappointed. Thank you for just being such an incredible group of people and for welcoming me. And I just really pray that all of us would take another step as we go home wherever you are, we're all in different places, wherever you are, God meets you right where you are. Take another step in giving your life to Him. And have some vision on where, if you're earlier in the process, of where He wants to take you. Thank you very much.